James Moore begins a very personal investigation, discovering the significant role women played in the development of fascism in Britain and the long-term effect their radical politics had on their children.
I'd like to tell you a story about me and my mum. When I was 11, she took me up to London to visit her birthplace in Kennington. As we walked around, she showed me where the air raid shelters were during the war, and then she told me about the black shirt meetings. At 11, it didn't mean much to me, but it's played on my mind ever since. The black shirts, I now know, were the uniformed members of Oswald Mosley's pro-Nazi fascist movement. I could have ended up in prison, she said.
Brother black shirts, my comrades, in struggle. Our fight is for the soul of Britain, and in that battle we go forward together till victory be won. Our struggle is hard, because we are fighting for something great, and great things are not lightly or easily gained.
We are fighting. My mum, follower of Mosley, a fascist black shirt? Surely not. But the words prison and black shirts aren't easily erased from my memory. Years later, I've decided to ask her about it again, for better or worse.
Hey, Mum?
Mum's 88 now and lives in a small flat on the south coast. Once we sat down with a cup of tea, she began telling me about the ink factory she worked in as a young girl.
Well, at first I went to Waterman's, horrible place, packing bottles of ink. It was awful.
What about that friend you made at, would that be at the ink factory?
Primrose.
Tell me about Primrose.
We got very friendly. Nobody liked her, so I made friends with her. And she invited me home to tea one day. And there was her brother there and her mum. And they got talking about black shirts.
And what was Primrose like? Can you describe her for me?
She had all spots on her face, I know that. Nobody liked her. She didn't speak to anyone very much. She kept herself to herself. Apart from me, she seemed to want to make a friend of me, you know? And I fell for it. But I think, really, it was just to get me to be a black shirt.
I've never really been aware of black shirt women. In documentaries, you only ever see the men parading about in paramilitary garb. I knew about the daughters of English aristocrats like Dinah Mitford, who married Oswald Mosley, but my mother was a teenage girl working in a factory. To begin to understand what attracted all types of women to the movement, I wanted to know more about how fascism began in Britain in the first place. I spoke to historian Julie Gottlieb, author of the book titled Feminine Fascism.
Well, the first fascist movement, the first called the British Fascisti, then changed his name to the British Fascists, formed in 1923, surprisingly enough, by a woman, Miss Rothaw Linthorne Orman. And she came from a reactionary right-wing background, but still wanted to integrate these new opportunities that women had discovered through patriotic organizations and war work itself into the far right.
So the first British fascist movement was actually founded by a woman?
Surprisingly enough, it was, which is very unusual and really makes British fascism stand out from the beginning as an organization that had a special relationship, if we might say, with women and with politicized women in particular.
Until then, the most prominent political movement for women had been the suffragettes. One of the most influential suffragettes was Nora Elam. She was in charge of propaganda and imprisoned for making inflammatory speeches on women's suffrage. Sent to Holloway Prison in 1914, she shared a cell with Emmeline Pankhurst, leader of the British suffragettes. But I was shocked to discover that Nora Elam was imprisoned again in the Second World War, and this time with Dinah Mosley, wife of the fascist leader. What had led a suffragette like Nora to become a black shirt? Like me, Angela and Susan McPherson, Nora's granddaughter and great-granddaughter, have been on a quest to find out more about their family's history. They knew little about the colourful past of their Granny Elam.
As a result of her activities, we were a bit of a dysfunctional family, and I'd left home at 15 and never went back. And so I had actually blocked out most of it, apart from two facts. One, that she was a suffragette, and something else she always used to tell me when I was a little girl. And so I'd sort of blocked it all out, and it wasn't until Susan said, I want to find out about her, shall we look into it, that all my memories started waking up. And then we started on this journey and came across some amazing information that I had just completely forgotten and blocked out.
Your grandmother's activities with the suffragettes, can you tell me what she did?
Nora, in fact, ended up writing a lot of suffragette propaganda, giving many, many, many speeches, and a warrant was issued for her arrest for making inciting speeches. And she was convicted of making inciting speeches and taken away to Holloway and force-fed.
Susan, let me turn to you. I mean, what are we talking, 1914 here? We're talking, yes, the First World War.
When I established that it was true that she was a suffragette and that she had known the Pankhurst, she had been in prison, I was just amazingly sort of proud. I was like, this is fantastic, you know, this is something to be proud of. But one of the first references that came up on Google was also said something about 18B. And I thought, and then I saw her name, Nora Elam. I thought, I don't know what 18B is. So, you know, I'm sure that's something very important. But then we started looking into it and I realised what 18B meant. It was part of a law that was passed shortly before the Second World War, which allowed people to be arrested without trial. And it was designed mainly to intern people who were thought to be suspect, potential spies, and most of the British Union of Fascists.
Ah. So you set out on a journey to research a grandmother that you're very proud of because she's a suffragette.
Yep.
And then you discover in the course of this that she was imprisoned in the Second World War as well as the First,
yep,
but this time for being a black shirt.
Yep. Yep.
That must have been a bit of a shock.
It was a shock. And this is when we sort of had lots of phone calls between each other. And, you know, I'd ring up and say, are you sure this is the right person? And, you know, my mum was quite shocked on the phone.
It seemed extraordinary, so I asked Julie Gottlieb if their story of Nora Elam was unique. Had other suffragettes become prominent fascists too?
They certainly did. In the 1920s, not so much, although Mary Allen, one of the main ex-suffragettes to identify herself with fascism, did have some connections with that first organization, the British Fascisti. But it was in the 1930s that the British Union of Fascists attracted three quite high-profile ex-suffragettes, one of whom, Mary Richardson, actually became the head of the women's section of Mosley's organization.
Having secured the vote, many suffragettes were disillusioned by not being represented at the top of the various political parties of the day. Some felt that only the fascists offered equal rights for women within the party structure. So I now understand how intellectuals like Nora were attracted to the black shirts. But what about women like my mum? Was it the comradeship? Or merely the appeal of the smart black shirt uniform, perhaps?
It's a great marketing tool, and there's nothing that can be said to deny that. The black shirt was what identified the movement. They were the black shirts, and the fact that women were in black shirts or in black blouses, to clarify, they didn't actually wear black all over. They were in black shirts and grey skirts. Otherwise, it would be tempting to call them the black skirts. It was an incredible draw for every generation, but mainly for youth.
So this was an appeal to women at that time, was it, to be marching about in the streets in this uniform?
Well, some historians have called the 1930s the Battle of the Shirts, and of course to wear the uniform was a way of identifying yourself and of identifying your gang, your crew, your kind of horde, and women were drawn to this as much as young men were. And in fact, of course, it was, as I say, the importance that had been placed on women in uniform in the First World War as a way of identifying women's progress, because women were being allowed into what had been only male-only spheres by donning the uniform. Therefore, the uniform has these various symbolic resonances. And how it really appealed to young working-class people was the uniform, but also the way the movement was organized on social grounds. The movement was organized often on the basis of social activities.
My mother has told me a story of how, when she was working at the Waterman's Ink Factory in Vauxhall, that they attempted to recruit her there. Does that sound plausible to you?
It does sound plausible, and that sounds plausible in that the efforts were made at certain places of work and factories and so forth to recruit younger members and older members as well. And this would have been built upon after that with the inducement of the social aspect of the movement.
And young women were involved. It's the evening of the 16th of July, 1939, just 6 weeks before the outbreak of war. And the British Union Drum Corps, dressed in their black shirts and grey skirts, all of them women, proudly lead Oswald Mosley into the Earls Court Arena. Playing to a crowd of 30,000 people, at least a quarter of whom were women. As the black shirt movement grew in the 1930s, my mum, who was still just a young girl, said that they became more visible on the streets of Kennington, where she lived.
You were aware of the politics that was going on in that part of London at the time?
Because it was going on all the time.
What was going on?
All these crowds gathering.
You saw it, did you? You saw the black shirts?
I've come over to the Lambeth Archives in London, the part of town where my mother was brought up. She said to me that she remembered black shirts fighting in the streets around here, and so I wonder if there's any evidence left of those riots that took place.
A lot of light and heavy industry in the area with very, very anti-war left-wing policies.
Local historian Neil Bright said Kennington was predominantly a left-wing stronghold and that there were violent clashes with the black shirts.
There's a terrible series of incidents in Long Lane in 1937, actually in October, clashes with the police, the black shirts and the left-wing supporters.
I see you've got some pictures here as well.
In one of the photos, there's horses intervening between the two rival factions. One of the other photos showing the St John's Ambulance or the Red Cross treating casualties for head wounds. Barricades were put up and torn down, thrown at each other. Terrible, terrible day.
And is this the sort of thing that's still remembered in this part of London now?
There's not a lot of archive material on this. I've spoke to one or two elderly people and they don't recall the incidents directly.
Frankly, I'm not surprised that my mother saw black shirts on the streets of London. After all, events like the Battle of Cable Street are well known. But I was surprised when I heard about Diana Bailey, who painted fascist slogans on the streets of Bognor Regis as a girl. She clearly remembers her mother and her father in their black shirt uniforms.
They were robed and attired in these rather horrific garments, and it used to embarrass us children very considerably because my mother would be selling papers on the corner of the street and things like that, and our friends were very, very disgusted with this.
So you would see your mother and your father dressed in their black shirt uniforms?
Yes.
Selling newspapers on the street?
Yes. It was humiliating. We also were taken out in the evening and paint the streets with Britain Awake and PJ, Perish the Jews, and all sorts of things like that. So we were part of the team that painted the slogans on the walls.
So how old would you have been when you started painting fascist slogans on walls?
About 9 and 10. Yes, my brother would be 7 and 8. That's when we started. You know how children rather enjoy something that's a little bit extreme. So we rather enjoyed it. subsequently, of course, you know, it had horrible consequences, but, you know, at the time, I seem to think I felt rather proud about doing it.
And your parents would take you along to black shirt meetings?
They did. They did, yes.
Can you describe those meetings for me?
Well, they were usually in the same place. It was a fishmonger called Mr. Howe, and I remember various people who used to come to these meetings. They were always the same people. I can't tell you what they were talking about because I really can't remember, because it was mostly to do with the leader and the fascists and the BU, they used to call it, so that we were very bored with the context of the meeting as children, but we were sitting in the back.
And by the leader, you mean Oswald Mosley?
Absolutely.
My mother had no interest in politics. But then, neither did Francis Beckett's mother, Anne. His mother was also a young working woman who was randomly sent along to Mosley's headquarters by the Pitman's temp agency to work as a secretary.
What she really wanted to be was an actress. And she tried very hard to become an actress. She did have a season at what was then called the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre. But she had long periods of resting, as actors did then and do now. And during one of these periods, she made what she all her life regarded as a most dreadful mistake. She learned shorthand. And once a woman in those days learned shorthand, she was done for. Shorthand was what she did. And she went to Pitman's, who handed temps out. Pitman's sent her to Black House in Chelsea, the headquarters of the British Union of Fascists, where she worked for two people, the second one being Dr. Robert Forgan, the deputy leader. She knew nothing. She knew the theatre, she knew drama, she knew all that. Politics she knew practically nothing about, but she found it rather an exciting place to be and slowly learned the collectivist side of the politics. Never, ever, I think, learned the racist side of the politics, and was never, ever herself a racist, though she worked among racists.
Would she have come across Oswald Mosley there?
She would have come across Mosley, certainly. Mosley a great deal. Forgan even more so. All the top people. William Joyce, of course, she knew extremely well.
Joyce, better known as Lord Haw Haw, later hanged for his Nazi propaganda broadcasts during the war. It was at fascist headquarters that Anne met and later married one of the blackshirt elite, John Beckett, Francis's father. He was sent to prison with Oswald Mosley during the war, as a result of which they spent the rest of their lives living hand to mouth.
There wasn't really a racist bone in her body. She wasn't an anti-Semite, but she'd been a member of an anti-Semitic organisation. She had no racism about black people, although she lived with a man who was really grossly racist about black people. She knew he was a fraud, fundamentally. But she defended him, she was loyal to him, she cared about him until the day she died. The political beliefs that I have are broadly those that I'd have had in any case. I might have been less interested in politics, I might have taken less time about them, but I'd have ended up in broadly the same place. I was never in the smallest bit tempted by my father's racism. I could tell what it was. It was the one thing about him that I really found it instantly repellent. Nothing else, because, I mean, the fact that he didn't believe in democracy, I didn't find particularly repellent. I didn't agree with it. But his racism, the casual, crude things that he would say about Jews, about black people, that was the one thing about my father that I really found utterly repellent. And the one really miserable memories I have of him are of him using phrases like Jew boy. A sentence that he said about black people that I can't really even bring myself to say.
Are there things about your parents that you're ashamed of?
Well, my mother was not a racist. Am I ashamed of my father's racism? No, I'm appalled by it. I look at it and I think, how can an intelligent, humorous, humane man as he was have described other human beings in the terms in which he did describe them? I don't understand that.
Seeing how easily Francis's mother had become a blackshirt, I asked my mum if something similar had happened to her with her factory workmate Primrose and her fascist family.
They got talking about blackshirts. And I was talking all about these meetings that they went to. And I suddenly realised, I thought to myself, I don't know. I think they got me here for a reason.
Were they talking about people like Oswald Mosley?
Yeah, that's what made me realise, because I knew that he was something to do with these crowds. Mm. You know, I realised that this is what they had me there for.
Mm. And but so after this, you broke off your friendship with Primrose, mm. did you? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, when we was at work the next day, she said, "Why did you go off like that?" I said, "Well, because I wasn't interested in what you were talking about." Right. And that was that. I gave him a notice.
You gave him your notice because of this tea with Primrose?
Mm. I wasn't interested in politics at all.
No, which is why I was very surprised when you said, "I could have ended up in prison in the war."
Do you remember
you saying that? Yeah, you said that, yeah. Well, a lot of the women black shirts did, didn't they?
I reckon they did.
After all these years, it turns out she never was a black shirt after all. I can stop imagining my mum sitting in the rows of a mass meeting, Zeke hailing the leader and being hauled off to Holloway Prison. Her brush with the black shirts never went further than tea with Primrose and her family. But Diana Bailey, who, as a child, painted fascist slogans with her parents, gave me a taste of what my life could have been like if my mother had been recruited that day.
When I was 13, I was at boarding school, and I was reading the newspaper in the common room, and the headline said, "Naval Officer's Wife Interned," and I was reading on, and I saw it was my mother. I was interned in 18B. And that's really when suddenly everything came home.
So there you were, a schoolgirl, away at school,
yeah.
At the age of 13, and you read in the newspaper that your mother's been taken to Holloway Prison.
That's right, yes. It was utterly shaming and horrific, really. I think I nearly fainted. I was rather given to fainting at those days. But having read that, I was completely appalled. And I remember taking her some fruit and ringing at this big doorbell and giving her number, which I remember, F4114796, and going in and seeing my mother, who was only 38 or 39 years old at the time. Her hair had gone white. She looked completely distraught. She was crying all the time. We were sitting at a table, sitting opposite her, and I felt, in a terrible way, almost repulsion, because she was so different from what I'd seen before. She wasn't my mother at all.
Of the almost 1,000 BU members interned during the war, about 100 were women, so that's about 10%.
Historian Julie Gottlieb.
Women would not have been seen as such a threat to national security as men, but the fact that 100 fascist women were seen as enough of a threat is interesting, isn't it?
In your researches, as you've been writing about these women, what feeling have you got from their children? What effect these women's involvement in fascism has had with their families up until today?
The interesting thing about a movement like the British Union of Fascists, which was a marginal movement, which was seen very much as a pariah among political parties, is that, you know, in the post-war period, after the Second World War, especially because of the episode of internment, there was often a great deal of shame connected to these family relationships and the fact that, you know, your mother or your father had been a prominent member of this organization. So there are very different reactions, depending on many things. Of course, there were some children who would have continued and remained faithful to their parents' belief systems and joined post-war fascist movements and far-right organizations. But I think it's fair to say that the vast majority, and certainly the people who want to come forward and speak about their past, are people who have been traumatized in various ways by this family history.
Angela and Susan McPherson, whose grandmother was the former suffragette and black shirt Nora Elam, told me how Nora had emotionally damaged her own son, and how this damage had been passed down the generations of their family. Angela couldn't even refer to her father in any other term than Nora's son.
He was a very unhappy man, very unhappy man. I mean, a misogynist with a wife and three daughters is never going to be happy. And he was a dreadful bully. And he learnt all that at Nora's hands. There is no question about that. I never saw him from the day I was 15, only once. and I couldn't run away from him fast enough.
What we didn't know before we did all this was that Nora's own father had been a tyrant and a bully, and this is what led her to her hatred of men, radical feminism. And yet the irony is that she turned her son into her father, effectively. So
yes.
So in some ways it's been a learning curve for us, understanding, you know, why things have happened to us the way they have.
Yeah.
Within the context of sort of intellectualising this woman, Nora.
Yes.
And, you know, where she put all those energies. But there is a huge irony, I think, in her life. I used to hate him for what he'd done to my mum and for some of the ways that she is. And having done all this, I now understand that that came from someone else and that came from someone else. And, it's sort of been rolling down the generations. And it's, you know, I no longer hate him. I just kind of hate some of the things that have come down. But we can explain it now and understand it and integrate it into our lives better.
A great deal of damage has been done, hasn't it?
Yes.
It goes on and on and on.
Well, now I hope we've stopped it now.
Mm.
Because you know, Susan's got this beautiful little boy and he's growing up in this loving, caring home where he's just stimulated, loved, and I think finally after, what, 4 or 5 generations, we've finally broken.
And we couldn't get any further back than her father, but who knows where it started. Yeah.
How do you regard Nora? I mean, on the one hand, there is this heroine suffragette. On the other hand, there's the demonised fascist.
I can actually admire bits of what she did. Other parts, I still feel deeply ashamed about, because she was a dreadful racist.
For my family, it could have started in that ink factory in Vauxhall and that tea with Primrose. Life for me and my two brothers could have been so very different if my mother had not walked away that day. But Diana Bailey continues to live with the consequences of her parents' actions. She says she will never lose her feelings of guilt.
I passed through the barrier and found myself in the world of a nightmare. Dead bodies, some of them in decay, lay strewn about the road and along the rutted tracks.
Subsequently, when Richard Dimbleby went into Belsen, I suddenly felt the whole guilt of the world on my shoulders. And it was a huge sort of vault fast, and I turned round, and for the rest of my life I've tried to overcome what they were promoting. I did feel utterly responsible for what had happened in the camps in Europe because of what I'd done as a child, and I had said perish the Jews and I had painted PJ on the streets. So it was something that dug right deep into me, and I never to this day have got over that.
Mother Was a Black Shirt was presented by James Moore and produced by Neil George.